You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
I had a Vietnam vet tell me one time, Jeremiah, he goes, PTSD, it's like having a cage in your brain, it's like having a cage full of monkeys. The goal is to keep the monkeys in the cage, because once them bastards make the jailbreak, all hell breaks loose, so you want to keep them in the cage.
Yeah. Oh, man, that's awesome. Can you imagine, were you a Vietnam veteran, and you came home, and they told you to take your uniform off and don't talk about it and just forget about it?
I can't even imagine. I have so much respect for those guys.
.803 on the West Coast, 11:03 on the East Coast. Breaking news from the Associated Press. The Associated Press is reporting that China over the last year has created mass internment camps to, quote, re-educate Muslim detainees, erase their Islamic beliefs, and reshape their very identities. AP has a series of articles on that. Speaking of news, joining us from the East Coast, I believe is where he's at, is the editor of USNI News, Sam Legron. Sam, first of all, thanks for coming on All Marine Radio. I appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me.
First of all, we got to know about you so that we can know if we should believe you or not. Born and raised where?
All over the place. My old man was an Army Special Forces guy, so born in Fort Bragg and raised all over.
Born, okay, and raised all over. Educated with college where?
Virginia Military Institute.
You're a VMI guy?
Sure am.
Wow. This is always interesting. So from VMI, where do you go? Do you join the military? Does that cure you of your military instincts? What do you do after college?
I ended up at the News and Observer in Raleigh, North Carolina. I started working for newspapers when I was at VMI. I was really interested in journalism, and the military instructor for the Army ROTC program was just like, well, hey, you could be a public affairs officer if you join the Army. And I wasn't super interested in that option, so I ended up being a journalist for local newspapers, and then I switched over to defense trades in 2008, worked for the Air Force Times for a minute, and then I was the maritime correspondent for Jane's Defense Weekly for a few years.
So that gets you into the world of the Navy. And then tell everybody who's never heard of USNI News, tell everybody how to find you guys and what you guys do. I'm a fan.
Sure.
I'm a fan, so.
I appreciate it. So we are independent news wire, and we're part of the U.S. Naval Institute. And we've been around for about 5 years, and our mandate is to provide, you know, as close to the objective truth as we can on what's going on with the sea services. That's the Navy, Marine Corps, and the Coast Guard. And, you know, it's pretty straight down the line reporting. It's all fact-based, so it's warts and all. So we're ready. I describe it to people as like we're like the Ghostbusters. We're ready to believe the Navy and the Marine Corps, but we want to make sure that the information is correct. And, you know, we verify everything, so we're just trying to be good, responsible journalists. And, you know, the nice part about working with the Naval Institute is it's not a think tank. You know, we don't have any kind of allegiances to any kind of corporations or any kind of, you know, government institutions or any kind of political parties. Members of the Naval Institute are interested in this independent thought about the sea services. We don't have a legislative agenda. And, you know, just, you know, bring your best idea for the organization as a whole. And then where we live inside of that is we're a completely independent news service. You can find us on news.usni.org, USNI News on Twitter, and then the U.S. Naval Institute on Facebook. And every day we just put out what's going on in the Navy, the Marine Corps, and the Coast Guard as best we can.
And where do people find it? How do they find it?
Oh, sure. It's news.usni.org. And it's online only. So it's news.usni.org, you know, on any local web browser.
Got it. Okay, so that's your background, and you're the editor there. And so where are you located? Are you located in D.C. or where?
We're spread out. We have a network of correspondents around the world right now. So our main hub is in D.C. We have a desk at the Pentagon. We also occasionally work out of Annapolis, where the Naval Institute headquarters is.
Ah.
And then we have folks on the road pretty often. I just had two reporters out on George H.W. Bush last week.
I wanted to have you on. I read some of the work you did relative to the court martials that are going on I believe they're going on at the Navy Yard in D.C., yes?
That's correct.
Can you give us the 10,000-foot view? Because one of the things, if you haven't been paying attention, there was a court martial last week for the officer of the deck of the USS Fitzgerald, and she had already been NJP'd, and then there's been an umbrella kind of put over both court martials. To ensure, well, can you explain this to us? We've all gone to, most of us, who've been in the Marine Corps, we've all gone to sea. We've been partners with the Navy. I mean, they're a different branch of the service than we do. They do different things. They do it better than anybody else in the world. And I think we've all watched with great concern, starting with the grounding of the USS Antietam in Tokyo Bay. The USS Lake Champlain running into a fishing vessel in broad daylight, and then the two collisions all happening in the Seventh Fleet. We scratch our heads like, what is going on? You know, we've done this stuff for decades and haven't seemed to have these kind of issues. What's going on out there? So we watched, I think, with great interest, and so maybe you can help us get our secret decoder ring out and explain some of this to us.
Absolutely. This is a story about the U.S. Navy surface forces, kind of writ large. So there's a lot of different takes on this because you're talking about essentially 70% of the fleet, 283 ship fleet. And I think the biggest thing to think about before you get into kind of the nitty gritty about Seventh Fleet and Japan versus other places is that 10, 15 years ago, there was a lot more ships underway doing the work to maintain about 100 ships underway at all times, right? So it was about a 1-to-4 ratio. So for every ship that you have underway, you have, three or so back in port getting worked on, people getting training and stuff like that. But that ratio has dropped about 100 ships or so underway on average, you have 283 ships supporting that. And so for the last, or for the 15 years of the low intensity ground conflict in Southeast Asia, the Navy was largely in a support role, especially the surface Navy, right? So you had your submarines doing the submarine stuff, sneaking around the coast, listening to things. And the surface Navy essentially was in a support role doing ballistic missile defense, in Europe and in Asia. And then, long range precision strike against targets with, Tomahawk cruise missiles. And that for about 15 years was the primary driver of what the surface force did. I mean, granted, there's other tasks, right? So a U.S. destroyer has a lot of things it's got to do. It has, is an anti-air warfare, mission. That's why there's that big SPY-1 radar, on the ship. It has a long range attack mission. That's why you had your Tomahawk there. It has an anti-submarine warfare mission. So there's sonars and all sorts of tracking devices there. It has a anti-surface mission and on and on and on and on. So they're called multi-mission combatants because you have more than a dozen tasks that each ship has got to do with a crew of only about 240-ish people to go and do it. So you have a lot of missions. You have crew sizes that are going down. And then more or less everything was steady state until 2014, where you start to have a resurgent Russia, and they're sending out ships, and they're sending out submarines, and they're sending out aircraft, and you're starting to have a buildup of the Chinese People's Liberation Army Navy, right? They're building ships like crazy, and they're operating further and further and further afield, and it's putting stress on the forces that are forward deployed to Japan, right? So there's about essentially a carrier strike group's worth of ships that the United States has forward deployed in Yokosuka, Japan, in order to get out underway whenever they can. So a lot of those ships, instead of, you know, being CONUS-based, where you can, like, leave San Diego and, you know, have some time to train and kind of ease into whatever your roles and your missions are, the surface ships out stationed out in Japan, they're on it immediately, right? And they're doing it immediately. And I think since those the grounding and the three collisions, there are a bunch of investigations have come out and found that these ships are stressed, and the maintenance is inconsistent, and the manning is not where it's supposed to be, and that problem has always been there in the Western Pacific. I talked to an old sailor who worked in 7th Fleet in the 70s, and he was just like, USS, right? That's underway Saturday and Sunday. I mean, it's always been really busy, but the indications now that in the period when these collisions have happened, that an already difficult job has gotten all that much harder because of all of these difficulties. And sorry to do the long windup, but just set the backdrop of what these court martials are all about.
Right. So let me, let me throw this out there. We who have deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria have done so at our own incredible pace. Okay. And we look at the Navy, and they, especially the surface Navy, and they got a pass. They go to sea. It's what they do. John McCain, you know, rails on the 100 hour work week. Right. We laugh at it. Are you kidding me? The 100 hour work week is 14 hours a day. That means I would have 10 hours to myself a day. We don't get that when we deploy. And so, to me, we look at the Navy and say, what a joke. What are you doing? If you have 10 hours to yourself a day, what are you doing that leaves you so on your ass that you can't even navigate the ship safely? You're the officers of the deck can't even hit either a collision alarm or a general quarters alarm 60 seconds before you collide, which would have saved all 17 of those guys because they would have been out of their rack and up a ladder within 60 seconds. I would almost virtually guarantee you, as somebody who spent 2 years aboard, you know, as ship's company aboard a United States aircraft carrier. And so we look at this and we see these things and we've deployed, right? And when we're not good, people get dead. People lose body parts. And we see these lame-ass excuses. And in my opinion, this whiny-ass culture of the Navy that says they're so overworked because they got to go to sea on Saturday and Sunday, and we just scratch our heads and we think, what is going on in that culture that they are now so soft that they can't do these things, and they think that a 100-hour work week when you're deployed is so wrong, right? It's so hard, it's so wrong. And so that's why I wanted to have you on, because we scratch our heads and we don't understand it.
As to what John McCain said about the 100-hour work week, I really can't speak to that as much as I can to sort of the larger kind of demographic trends inside 7th Fleet and the surface Navy as a whole. Again, I'm not a sailor. I don't work for the Navy, but I think there would be some surface sailors that would probably take issue with that characterization of, you know, how they're worked and how they do it. Because just like, you know, you're underway and you're on a ship and you're moving and you're steaming and there's just a lot of stuff to be done and your head has to be on a swivel and there's no break. But again, I think the larger trend is, you know, without speaking to, you know, whether anybody's soft or not, I think there's the task that the surface Navy has had to do and the pressure they've been under has accelerated, I think, in the last 3 to 4 years. I think that's pretty inarguable, especially when you start looking at the Government Accountability Office reports for, you know, the amount of underweight days versus days in port and days in training, right? So if you want to talk about a cultural issue inside the surface Navy, I think, you know, maybe the best place to start is to talk about, you know, comparing them with the other communities that are inside the Navy itself, right? So the two big ones are submariners and the aviation guys.
So let me ask you, as you look at it, is this kind of a collision of a number of issues? One, maybe a cultural issue, and then another one being an operational issue. And then all these incidents happen in 7th Fleet. Is there a reason why they only happen in 7th Fleet? You know, and so your thoughts on that?
The culture issue, I think, is a big one. I think it's a big one, and I think the Navy more or less has admitted it in the two reviews that it's done after the collisions, right? And again, if you look at the aviation community, they paid in blood for a lot of the safety restrictions that they have now, like the NATOPS, right? Sort of these are the Naval Aviation Standard Operating Procedures, and we will not derivate from them because we are unsafe, right? The submariners had, you know, an incident where they lost the USS Thresher,
right?
You know, due to parts being out of round. Pardon me. And so they have a big safety culture there because they paid for it in blood. The aviators lost about 12,000. It's a staggering number. It's about 12,000 aircraft and about 8,000 Navy and Marine flyers, aviators, due to incidents. It includes combat, but the combat is such a small percentage relative to the accidents on carriers. So these are two communities that have paid in blood for the safety standards that they have now, and planners have to deal with. The surface guys have incidents, but it's never coalesced into like, hey, you know, this is a hard line that we can't cross. We need to have X level of training. We need to have X level of sleep. We need to have all these safety standards because it's a ship and it's floating already. They'll go to sea with broken parts. They'll go to sea with a gap fillet in a way that a submarine won't, in a way that an aviation detachment won't. And so that's already a can-do culture there with like, all right, well, you know, we've got spit and baling wire and we'll fix it on the way. And that's contributing to this, you know, so you gotta have a lot of holes in the Swiss cheese line up so you can put your finger in there, right?
Right.
So, you know, it's never one thing.
But again,
these incidents happen. It's always 15, right. 16 different things that combine together.
I'm with you on that. But you know, it's not like a submarine can say, yeah, we're not deploying. It's not like a carrier air wing can say, yeah, you know, we don't have the spare parts, so we can't go. You know, you're going one way or the other. You're going. And even if you failed all your ready X's, we don't have another interchangeable piece to send out there that's more ready than you. So pack your trash. You're going to get on that ship and you're going to go and you're going to unscrew yourself. So it's not like even the submariners or the aviators can say, we're not going and we're not doing that. Now they can mitigate the way they go and do it. So I get your point about NATOPS, and I get your point about the Thrasher and the hard lessons learned that maybe the surface Navy doesn't pay for their mistakes in the same way, but it's not completely, there are similarities in the culture that even in the submariners and the aviators, they still have to answer the bell. They still have to go. And so, I don't know. I don't want to let the surface guys off the hook because again, as an infantry guy, you know, with deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan, I hear the Navy's whining and I think you guys are bullshit. You guys have gotten soft and you guys are bullshit. And you paid for it, and there's no way anybody, and I know I'm going to sound like a hard ass because I'm going to keep bringing this up, the fact that you don't sound collision alarms, there's no excuse for that when you see a ship coming. There's no excuse for that other than dysfunctional, incompetent people. And how the hell does that happen? And where is the CO when you're transiting? Where is the CO when you're transiting a busy navigational strait with orders to the OD to transit it at 20 to 22 knots? Where is the XO? Nobody's going to be on the deck. Where's the navigator? Where's the adult? Right? And the same thing, why don't we set the sea and anchor detail? Basic stuff in the Moluccan Straits. Hello? Most ships do that. My ship was at general quarters. And so you see this basic stuff, and then you hear this pushback that we're too busy, and you think, you're too busy to do the basics? That doesn't make any sense to me. And can I ask you a data point, and then you can have the floor again. And this is why I brought you on, to make us smart, because I look for people that can footnote these things to us, because they are complex issues. But again, we've gone to sea with them. We know them, and we love them, and they take us everywhere we go, and we want to understand. Is it not standard operating procedures to have lookouts anymore on the exterior of a ship? Is that a thing of the past?
Well, everything's in transition now because I think a bunch of standards have changed since the collision. But I think before that, I think it's all conditional. So if you were to look at, and again, I'm not an advocate for the Navy here, right, and I'm not, an advocate for any of those people on trial. But
I'm just looking for a data point. Is that we don't
sure?
Because I used to go ahead.
Yeah, lookouts when you come in and out of port, right? I think if you look at specifically the Fitzgerald, they had no awareness, according to the testimony in Lieutenant J.G. Sarah Coppock's trial, who was the officer of the DAT. They weren't aware that they were crossing a voluntary separation. They didn't know.
Chart. Explain to everybody what a voluntary separation is.
Sure. A voluntary separation is a sea transit lane that's essentially a big superhighway in the middle of the ocean, and it's a way for people to voluntarily, so it's not required to enter a lane of travel in a certain direction, and so everybody's kind of moving the same way, and everyone has an awareness that this is the superhighway, and I need to be able to act accordingly. Because all the other ships are sort of moving in a sort of similar pattern.
Okay, got it.
Does that make sense?
Yep. And so everybody, most of us know that have been around the world. You have shipping lanes. You have aviation lanes in the sky. So it's the way that the sea and the sky is organized around the world, so that it makes sense and it eases the movement of ships and aircraft. So it's how we do it. So, all right. Thank you.
But there are indications that they weren't aware how potentially busy that the traffic was. The OOD wasn't there in the navigation brief. Their quartermaster billet had been gassed since 2015. So they hadn't had a quartermaster chief for about 2 years. And again, I'm not making excuses, but these are sort of the facts that are kind of slowly coming out here.
Right.
So one of the reasons that these court-martials are so important is we still really don't have a very clear picture of exactly what happened.
Okay. I'm glad you said that, because I don't feel so bad, because I've been watching this stuff because when I was a lieutenant many, many years ago, 1985, I was part of the Marine detachment aboard the USS Ranger, which was a fossil fuel aircraft carrier. We deployed to the Northern Arabian Sea, and every time we got within 50 nautical miles of the Iranian coast, we conducted Operation Gunmount, which was we had 50 cals and on all the sponsons. Marines manned them. Because we had intelligence that the Iranians knew that the SeaWiz didn't track anything, the ship's air defense system didn't track anything, one of the systems, slower than 120 knots, I think it was, and that they knew that, and they had plans to load Cessnas with explosives and kind of try to fly it into the ship. And so, well, how do you prevent that? If the SeaWiz not going to engage it as a last resort, who will? And so we went out there. So if the CO wasn't on the bridge, I went down to the CIC, So I had, and again, I'm an infantry officer. And so I've watched them, you know, the Navy navigate, both from the bridge, and I've seen what CIC does in terms of on a nightly basis prosecuting the surface plot as you identify ships, you identify their direction, you navigate the ship, you know, you identify threats and all that. So kind of unique for an infantry officer to have those experience. So I've been watching because, you know, I don't understand, right? And I don't understand. And then the other part of this that I don't understand is, I don't understand the facts, so that's why I'm glad you said that these things are starting to come out because we don't have a good picture of how they were configured that night. The other thing I don't understand is when these conditions exist and you're the commanding officer, you're the operations officer, you're the executive officer, we backstop weaker junior officers during complicated events with other adults that sit there and have a cup of coffee and make sure that it's going right. Right. And then, you know, and so there's, and that's called leadership. It's called supervision. It's what leaders do. And so, yeah, it's not, you're going to go to sea and it's not going to be perfect. Right. You rarely go to sea Philip Brown. You rarely go to war Philip Brown. But where you're weak, where you have issues, there's tends to be adults standing there with their hands in their pockets, or at least one hand, drinking a cup of coffee, just hanging out. Well, why do good leaders do that? Well, they do that because they know things are going to go wrong, and they know they're going to have to give rudder steer to get people through this stuff, and then they can go back to sleep once you're through it. So, so it's this picture that we're kind of looking at. So it makes me good to hear you say that we don't really have a good sight picture, because it would seem to me fairly basic that if you're going to transit a shipping lane, that you have an adult on the bridge, that you have you've augmented your lookouts above deck, especially if you've had any kind of issues with your radars, and that's just business as usual. Those, and once we get done with the transit, then we go back to ops normal. So it doesn't, I don't feel so bad because I've been struggling to figure out how were they configured, you know, before another ship drove into them in the middle of the night.
Well, so what we know definitively is, it has come out in, an abbreviated, we've been calling it Jagman Light, or a Judge Advocate General's Manual Investigation Light that came out, I want to say sometime last year after the explosion. I want to say in September, but you got to check me here. I don't have my stuff in front of me. But and it had some basic outlines of what happened, but we didn't know what was the watch bill supposed to be like that day. You know, why, you know, when did they start their day? When did they leave? When did they, you know, what other tasks did they have to do? Why were they going 20 knots? And there's still a bunch of questions that kind of remain to be answered. And a lot of those are going to be difficult to get because the Navy conducted this, under a dual use admiralty investigation. And what a dual use admiralty investigation is, sorry to get legally esoteric here, is an investigation that's designed to limit the liability of the Department of the Navy in case they have an incident with a civilian ship. And that's what this is. So in the JAG manual, or the Judge Advocate General's manual for the Navy, there's a whole section devoted to these dual-use investigations to limit the liability of the United States Navy. It goes down to like MWR paddle boat runs into fishing vessel. And the idea is this document is designed to conduct an investigation from the Navy, but it is privileged, right? So like attorney-client privilege. So it's not classified, but it's privileged because information in there could expose the Department of the Navy to liability from any, like, the merchant owners of the ACX Crystal or, you know, any other party that was potentially affected in that. So that makes it really difficult because we don't have the full view of the investigation that everybody has. We just have this very abbreviated summary that has some detail but kind of glosses over some others.
Got it.
And so there's lots of reasons to go to court-martial, but one of the largest reasons that this court-martial is important, or the series of court-martials is important. So right now, the OOD, the person who was in charge of the bridge at the time, she pleaded to, in a special court martial, she pleaded guilty to one count of Article 92, dereliction of duty, which is the same charge that she faced at NJP pretty shortly after the incident. She had previously faced, we understand, hazarding a vessel and negligent homicide, which are pretty unprecedented charges for an incident like this. And those similar charges are have been preferred to the two senior officers in PIC, their two lieutenants there, and then the captain who was asleep in his stateroom when the collision occurred.
Okay, hey, Sam, could you explain? My guest today is the editor of USNI News, and we all know they also publish Proceedings. Yes, Sam?
Yes, that's I have a counterpart who publishes Proceedings, so they're also part of our organization. They do all of it's essentially an academic peer-reviewed journal for sea service issues,
right.
And they also have they've launched a new online opinion editorial portal called Proceedings Today. So they handle the opinions and the analysis, and then we just do the news.
So Sam is the news arm of that. You can find them at news.usni.org. There's a whole bunch of great articles up there right now that have to do with the Naval Services. Sam, could you explain the authority that was appointed to oversee both the McCain and the Fitzgerald? Because again, one of the odd things I thought about Lieutenant J.G. Coppock's court-martial was that she had already been NJP'd for the same thing. And so then that authority that would oversee all of it said, yeah, that's not enough. She's going to be court-martialed as well. Could you explain that kind of umbrella authority and what the Navy's seeking to do with it, and then specifically what happened to her?
Sure. It's going to be pretty similar to what happened to Commander Bryce Benson, who's the former commander of the Fitzgerald, and then it's also going to be pretty similar to Lieutenant Woodley and Lieutenant Combs, who are also facing similar charges. So in late last year, as these investigations were going on, right, so you had these three collisions and a grounding. Two of them were fatal. 17 sailors are dead. So the Navy internally does a comprehensive review of everything that's going on in the surface forces to generate recommendations to how to improve. The Secretary of the Navy carries on a parallel strategic readiness review to go and look at that. And when they present their findings in early the Navy or the Navy investigation presents in early November, and then a little later on, the Secretary of Navy's investigation comes out. During that time, Vice Chief of Naval Operations Admiral Bill Moran appoints a consolidated decision authority. And so what a consolidated decision authority is a high-ranking member of a service, and he goes and looks at related cases to get an understanding and give equivalent punishments for them.
Okay.
So an example of where a CDA was involved was in the Taliban urination case with the Marines. They appointed a single General Amos at the time appointed a single consolidated decision authority to mete out equivalent punishments. So the idea is like you don't have these in separate venues, and one commander gives a much higher penalty or higher charges and more specifications than someone else. So the
okay.
idea is the CDA is the guy who sits and sort of in judgment to make sure that the punishments or the charges sort of all are kind of in balance
right.
with each other because
right.
of these related ones. So the CDA that was appointed was Admiral James Frank Caldwell, who is the current director of Naval Reactors, who oversees all of the nuclear programs in the Navy. And he ultimately was the person who determined that these sailors, these officers were going to face negligent homicide charges. And that's pretty unprecedented.
Right.
There's been, we did a short study of 13, 14 cases that look similar, everywhere from the Frank Evans to the incident with the USS Greenville when it came up under the Japanese ship killed some Japanese civilians. The Bell Snap, there's a lot of examples, but negligent homicide doesn't come up very often. So this is new, and there's a lot of speculation as why these charges were issued, but it gives you an idea that, you know, this consolidated decision authority, Admiral Caldwell, is taking this pretty seriously and issuing, charges in these incidents that, are atypical. And the NJT component of this is especially for the folks in the Fitzgerald. So most of those NJTs happened before the McCain collision on August 21st. So most of these sailors that are currently, either Lieutenant J.G. Kopic, who just had her trial ended in a guilty plea, and then the three other officers from the Fitzgerald who are currently facing negligent homicide charges, hazarding vessel charges, and dereliction of duty charges. All of those sailors had NJP, but Admiral Caldwell made a determination that wasn't enough and decided to go and put these charges on top of them. So there's a misconception that if you have NJP, you can't go to court-martial after that. It's rare, but it happens, and it's not double jeopardy like in a civilian court. Like in a civilian court, if you're convicted of acquitted of a crime, or you've met punishment for a crime, you can't be tried for that again. But in this instance, because of the nature of the NJP and the nature of the CDA made a determination that like these punishments weren't enough. They have to go and face these court-martial charges.
I have to tell you, and why I wanted you to explain that, because, you know, a Marine gunnery sergeant who hazed a recruit got 10 years in prison, and the recruit then jumped off the third deck at Parris Island and killed himself. He got 10 years in prison, and I was dumbstruck when I read in one of your articles and about Lieutenant J.G. Kopic, and I saw that she had been NJP'd. And I thought, so through your failure to do your duty, seven sailors get killed, and that's an NJP-able offense? I thought, wow. I was absolutely positively stunned, to be honest with you, that the Navy would have that kind of an incident and allow officers and the people in charge to be NJP'd, which is for misdemeanors, and it's not for felonies. And you could argue that even summary court-martials are kind of serious misdemeanors. You don't get serious justice in the military until you get the special courts and general courts. And so when seven people get killed through your own negligence, then we can argue about mitigating factors. I was speechless, and that's why I came looking for you. I said I need to find somebody who can explain this stuff, because this is if the incidents alone were bad enough, that this is what these officers are going to face, and you know, it was stunning to me. So I appreciate the explanation, and I appreciate your time this morning. The So now we're going to go through the second series of court martials ordered by Admiral Caldwell, and so are they all special court martials? Are any of them summary or general court martials?
So where we're at now as far as the court martials go is next week there's going to be a summary court martial for the DNC butler who was on the McCain based on a negligence charge, a summary court martial based on a negligence charge for not being able to, not properly certifying the watch team that was on duty. And so that should probably be pretty quick. Summary court-martial is kind of a heavier version of NJP.
Right.
When you're done with it, you don't have a federal conviction for a misdemeanor. You take your punishment and you're kind of on your way. The next day there's going to be a special court-martial for the commander of the USS John S. McCain, Commander Alfredo J. Sanchez, who was the skipper on the bridge on the McCain when the incident happened.
Right.
So the Fitzgerald situation is really complicated because there's so many overlapping pieces of what's going on there and why that happened. And it's still very difficult to tease out. The McCain incident is a little bit more straightforward.
Right.
It was a bridge crew from the Antietam, a bridge crew was cross-decked from the Antietam, which had suffered its own grounding. And so you had a bunch of sailors that didn't have a place to go. So they put them on the McCain. And so they were entering that the separation outside of Singapore, like we talked about earlier. It's essentially a superhighway for merchant ships heading into Singapore. And during the evolution, they had Commander Sanchez on the bridge overseeing the and mostly Antietam watch crew, we've learned. And he told them – we're still a little fuzzy on the specifics, but it was the equivalent of he told the watchstander, bring the ship back a third,
right.
Bring the throttle back a third. But there was a setting on the helm where the two screws on the DDG weren't linked. So when he brought it back a third, he only brought back, I believe it's the port screw a third. So they started drifting to port.
Okay, so
into another lane of traffic.
So for everybody, that's the left, okay? All right. Just remember, LP, just like your long playing albums of years ago, LP. And then if you want to remember right, think RS are consecutive letters in the alphabet, and that means right, starboard. That's how I used to do it, okay? So, but essentially they're both running parallel on this nautical superhighway. And what you have is through the lack of sinking of the propellers and the operators don't know that, the ship essentially turns left in front of a tanker that's going straight, a container ship that's going straight, and gets smoked. So I agree. So that one's easier. But the questions about that were, you know, that are amazing and dumbfounding are the captain is told by his XO and his OPSO that we should set the sea and anchor detail to get the most experienced navigators, helmsmen, and whatnot, you know, on the bridge and to the appropriate places, and he says no. And so it's just, you know, you see these things and you're just like, you shake your head. And having transited through the Moluccan Straits, it's a traffic jam. And you better, you know, we were at general quarters when we went through the Moluccan Straits on the USS Ranger. And it's a serious event to have that many vessels, both for security and just simply for navigation, when you have that many vessels in close proximity. And so, but I agree with you. I think that one's easier. They have the wrong people there. They have inexperienced people and they don't have the right people and they screw it up and they turn in front of a ship. But you know what I don't understand, Sam, is the lack of sounding. It's not like, you know, for a couple minutes before a couple, probably, you know, more than that, that you're going to collide and not sounding a collision alarm or general quarters to me is what's unforgivable, you know, and you know, why doesn't nobody thinks of hit the collision alarm? You know, I don't understand that. And that's to me unforgivable.
I think that's a major question that people still don't know. No, like during Coppett's trial, the question came up, and I mean, I don't think anybody found a really satisfactory answer on why it didn't happen. There was a JOD, there was a senior enlisted person at the helm, there was the conning officer, and then there were the OODs, and the switch was right there. And I don't think anyone had a good answer why they didn't hit that switch. I think the same thing for the McCain. You know, there are a lot of people on board, there were a lot of people on that bridge. Unlike the Fitzgerald Bridge, there were quite a few people on McCain, and right. There were several folks that could have hit that collision alarm.
They had they had several experienced folks. I got an email for you. Hey Mac,
sure.
First of all, thanks for doing this. I've been following this as well and don't understand some of the things. I'm glad to hear your guest make it make sense for us. Does he actually get a chance to go in and sit inside the court martials, or does he have to watch them via some other means, or is he simply delivered the transcripts of the court martial? Yeah, do you get to go, Sam?
Oh, I would love to get the transcripts. No, I'm there. So covering court martials as a member of the media is relatively restrictive. As opposed to, you know, I used to be do civilian criminal trials for a newspaper, and so you go in, you get checked into the Navy Yard, you have a little media personnel reporter pen that you hang out in between the case, and then you go in and you sit down there and don't have any recording devices, you can't have any computers, you can't have any watches, you can't have any smartphones, and you sit there with a legal pad and a pen. And write down everything that you hear and everything you can see and try to get the quotes the best you can, because you're not going to hear them again.
Wow.
You don't know what the exhibits are. You don't get to see the exhibit. So they'll pop up on a screen, and if you see a detail that's really interesting, you have to go and, like, write it down. So it's definitely a sprint and coast, because you'll be in, like, they'll be doing, like, motions, the indecipherable motions over specific pieces of evidence and like nomenclature or whatever. But then all of a sudden a document that popped up that, and this happened in the Coppock trial, a document popped up saying that the XO didn't trust certain members of the watch team. They're like, oh, you have to write that down real fast. So
right.
It can be harrowing, but it's pretty much the only way that we're going to be getting a lot of that information out there. So my news organization is committed to be going to these trials as they go along forward. So because it's pretty much the only way that we're going to get a lot of the answers, the circumstances around these cases.
Another email for you, Mac. Extremely interesting this morning, and I've been waiting for you to have your guest on since you mentioned it last week. My question is this. Does your guest think that Navy has focused too much on things like sexual harassment, sexual assault prevention at the expense of ship driving? And part B of the question is, why have all these incidents happened in the 7th Fleet? Is their seamanship that much worse? Thanks. Appreciate the program. Your thoughts, Sam?
Well, I think some people would argue inside the Navy, and I've heard folks in the Navy arguing that, you know, the amount of and not to single out sexual assault prevention and response training, but just all sorts of training in general, that there's too many must do's. Not to single out a specific type of training, but
right.
You know, DC or Norfolk or whatever sends down too many must-dos. You must have this training. You must have this training. You must have this training.
Right.
I think some of the commanders bristle about it a little bit, and you'll hear leaders complain about, the amount of training that they have to do that isn't relevant to war fighting. And I think there's a movement inside certain parts of senior leadership to try to pare that down to the essentials.
Right.
So that's part of it. And then what was the second part of the question?
Why the 7th Fleet?
I think folks that we've talked to, I think a lot of the smart folks that we've talked to about this problem, and the thing is like overstressing the surface force isn't anything new. It's not new. It's been a constant topic of conversation for maybe the last 18, 20 years. I think a lot of these collisions and the readiness problems that may have exacerbated, and made these things more likely to happen have been a topic of conversation for almost 20 years now. I mean, I would invite the y'all's listeners to check out the Belisle report from 2009. You can find it in the documents portal on news.usni.org, our website.
And how do you spell it?
Which is essentially a it's the Belisle. Oh, gosh, you have to ask me. B be let me look it up for you real quick.
Okay. Right.
But the Blau report was commissioned by a former head of Naval Sea Systems Command, Vice Admiral Blau, and he was brought in by Fleet Forces at the time back in 2009. To go and take a holistic view of what was going on with the surface fleet, right? So, you had problems with maintenance, you had problems with manning, you had, problems had been pretty endemic across the entire, surface fleet, and they were like, well, why is all of this happening? And so it's Balile, B-A-L-I-S-L-E report. If you Google Balile report, you'll be able to find it in a couple different places. So
B-A-L-A?
B-A-L-I-S-L-E. So okay. After Philip Balile. And if you Google it, it's pretty easy to find.
Okay, Balile.
But essentially you'll see a lot of problems that he outlined that, you know, I think folks in the surface force almost 10 years later are still complaining about it. And I think, you know, when you look at the system of surface warfare, and how it's employed across the world, the thing that's different about Seventh Fleet, or the thing that was different about Seventh Fleet, was it kind of outside of the normal force deployment process, right? So not to put anybody to sleep here, but the global force management process, essentially you have a bunch of flag and general officers go and argue, the geographical combatant commanders go to the force providers, which are the chairmen or the members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who's just like, hey, you know, European command, we need XYZ, and there's a big negotiation back and forth of like how many US-based assets get to go there, and it's a big food fight, you know, that they do on a pretty regular basis inside the Pentagon. Everybody gets together and tries to figure out what they can provide safely. The Pacific Fleet is a little different because, specifically Seventh Fleet, because they have a direct line to Pacific Fleet and Pacific Command. So those assets there and those surface ships there can get taskings outside of that global force management process, right? So So you're in for an availability, or you're in for a training period, or whatever. So I talked to a former sailor who was on the Fitzgerald in 2013, and he told me, it's like, hey, you know, we were in the middle of doing our training certification that we needed to get done to be certified to operate when we got pulled off to go and chase a Chinese submarine. And, you know, you just get told to do what you want to do, and it's outside, and none of that training, or people would feel, or people would tell us that they felt that training time and that maintenance time wasn't protected because they had to get out there and do operational tasking.
Right.
And after a while, all of that builds up. But the problem isn't necessarily isolated to the Western Pacific, but if you start to see breakdowns in the system, Seventh Fleet is probably the first place you start to see the seams.
So that theory postulates because of their higher operational tempo that the cracks are going to appear there first.
Right.
Okay. All right. Understood. We've got a few more minutes. I don't want to take up too much of your time this morning. I know you have a full-time job. This is kind of the general question. What about these incidents and the Navy surface warfare and these court-martials? Haven't I been smart enough to ask you that you think that the listeners of All Marine Radio need to know?
I think ultimately it comes down to a larger question that, you know, thinks about military force in general, which is, what do we really need these forces to do? Can you talk about what is the requirement, right? How much of these do you really need? And I think it's a conversation that's largely been punted. I mean, granted, there's a new national defense policy, a new national security issuance from Secretary Mattis,
right?
Kind of, you know, pointing in a clear direction. But you know, I asked the question to former Pentagon number two, Bob Orr, and I asked him, so what do you think the problem is? He used to be he was the Navy undersecretary, and he was like, it's a supply and demand problem, right? There's not enough supply to meet the demand, and if you can't make enough supply, I'm paraphrasing here,
but
if you can't make enough supply, now you have to think strategically, what do you really need to get done? And you can throw bodies at a problem, but then what happens when you run out of bodies, or if you only have a limited number? And so his point was, you know, sometimes you need to put the COCOMs on a diet and say, well, there's only so much that you can have because you're
we lost him. My guest this morning is the news editor. His name is Sam Legron. And for USNI News. And we know them. You've probably seen them, the magazine Proceedings. And he's the news editor of Proceedings. So, and I will tell you, here he comes. I thought you got mad and hung up, man. What's I didn't even say anything.
No.
I didn't even say anything. I'm like, come on, man. What's up with that?
I'm sorry. I'm not quite sure what happened.
No. Finish your thought.
Okay, so where did I leave off at?
Well, you were talking about the supply and demand, and sometime when you can't supply everything, you have to make choices.
Right, and that was Bob Work's point, and right. It was, you know, I mean, it's like the old Seinfeld bit, right? Serenity now, insanity later. and if you keep pushing maintenance, and you keep pushing training down the road for what's in front of you right now, eventually you're kind of stacking up a bill that you got to pay.
Right.
And I think the surface forces this, and you'll see these stories incrementally again, like none of these narratives are new about the surface force, about, how maintenance is, not as good as it could be, how, the fit bill or like the composition and the staffing of your ships, how it's not ideal. And again, you know, you go to war with the Navy that you have.
Right.
But there's trend lines where all of writ large and maybe part of administration, that is trying to get the money, part of it policy a long time ago, and then, you know, at the time that, you know, they look like they were penny wise, but have, you know, I think people would argue have proven pound foolish. And so it's this great overlapping, series of circumstances that have kind of, come to this one point where you see 17 sailors, who lost their lives, being symptomatic of larger issues of readiness with the surface force.
All right, let me read you an email, and then you can comment, and I'll let you go. And again, my guest is the news editor of USNI News. You can find them at on the internet at news.usni.org. Mac, I just tuned in, so forgive me. I have a very blunt question, and I'll ask it. From my Marine perspective, this seems to be the failure of leaders on those ships. Every one of us has deployed without everything that we would like. Every one of us has deployed with shortages relative to training. It's simply a fact of life. And we say that as guys who went and fought, who medevaced people for real, who went to real memorial service for people that got dead. When you're transiting a busy naval lane and you don't have your best people up there, what is the excuse for that? That is simply terrible leadership. And to see the things that have happened over and over and over again has been stunning to all of us.
the Navy looks like amateurs, not in the field of training, not in the field of maintenance, but in the field of leadership. When you know you have weak people, your job is to be on the bridge. Why are you asleep when you're transiting? These are the basic things I don't understand about what we're talking about. And the Navy can talk about operations and maintenance all they want. But to me, it's basic leadership. If somebody's too tired to be there, replace them, get somebody more senior there, and find out why, if they have 10 free hours a day, they're not sleeping. We know, even in Iraq and Afghanistan, the desire to play Game Boy, the desire to play video games, trumped the desire to sleep. It was our responsibility to shut those things off and make them sleep because they had to go out and fight. And if they weren't prepared to fight, people were going to die. So my question is this. To me, this is a Navy leadership issue. The errors on the bridge of the McCain and the errors on the bridge of the Fitzgerald beyond any type of training seem to me to be gross and not worthy of officers of the great naval tradition that we have, especially in the Black Shoe Navy. I know they're a proud group, but these things are rank amateurish. And if I just look at what I know to be true about the Fitzgerald, I believe I read that they didn't have any lookouts that night. The officers in the CIC don't know what's going on. Evidently, their radar was switched to long range, and so they weren't as aware of what was in proximity to the ship. And you have somebody on the bridge that the XO of the ship said, I believe I read it in USNI News, that he didn't have complete confidence in. This is the shit show that was crossing a major navigational way in the Pacific. Less than a day out of port. That's a joke. That's a leadership problem, and they should be fired, and I can't believe they're only going to summary court-martialed. Sorry for tuning in late and venting, but I've watched this, and I see it as a cop-out. It's leadership. We've all done it, we in the Marine Corps especially, and we know the consequences when you don't do it. Appreciate the show. Appreciate Mr. Legrone. Thanks for hearing. Please read this. Okay, I read it. All right, he vented. Sam, your thoughts on that? And again, this is unique. This is quintessentially Marine perspective as a naval partner and as kind of a different branch of the American military. So, welcome to our world.
Sure. No. I think the person writing in pretty much expresses, I think, a lot of the frustration that a lot of people feel about these individual cases. And just real quick, the commander is facing a full court martial for negligent homicide charges. It's not a summary court martial. So Commander Bryce Benson is actually yesterday he issued a statement saying that he's not taking a plea deal. He's going to see this thing all the way through.
Okay, and that is that at a general court or a special?
That is a general court-martial. Okay. I mean, you're right. Talking facing jail time for okay. negligent homicide.
All right.
But I think that's a big part of the frustration because think about when this just happened, when the fix just happened. The first thing that people thought about was that navigation system was hacked, radar was spoofed. You know, the ATX Crystal, the ship that hit it, was weaponized. All I fielded was conspiracy theories for about the first week and a half. I had a guy call me, say that, like, all right, so this is what happened. A Russian torsion weapon hit, you know, knocked out the bridge, and then a Chinese kilo popped up and hit it with a YJ-18. I was like, dude, I don't need your Reddit conspiracy theories. Like, that's kind of gross. But ultimately, everyone is confused and dismayed, and they don't understand what's happening. I'll tell you what was really telling in this particular Kopik's court martial during the sentencing period. They brought up the family members of folks that died, or I'm sorry, of the sailors who died in that berthing, unable to escape. And the effect that it had on their lives and how they reacted to it was confusing. It was despair and confusion because, you know, in my experience as a police recorder and someone who...
Come on, it's like a television show. What the hell? Stand by. Quit teasing us and then hanging up on us, man. What's wrong with you?
I'm sorry about that, man. But just to finish the point, you know, I've covered, criminal trials, where people, you know, have covered murder trials. I've spoken to people who've been in accidents. I've spoken to families, Gold Star families who've lost folks in military actions. And listening to the families, the tone was different, in the statements that they made during the sentencing. Because I think the difference is if your family member died in a training accident or they died in an action, you know, there's some, I don't want to say rationalization, but there's an understanding of what the purpose was. And when you listen to the families talk about how the effects of their lives are, or how their lives have been affected, they keep wrestling with the ideas. It's like, I don't have a why. They don't understand why this happened. And I think their sentiment shared, I think, with a lot of the public who still don't understand why did this happen. And how it's affected them versus other families who suffered losses either in the military or through accidents or through crime, they sounded different. It felt different listening to them because they didn't have any kind of explanation for what was going on. And I think that I think to a much, much lesser degree that sentiment is shared by people who've been watching these cases because the why isn't readily apparent either through you know, how opaque the investigation is by its design, and by the limited information on what those steps are moving forward in the future. To be fair, the Navy's done a good job with us, briefing us every quarter on, you know, this is how the mitigation is happening. Actually, the Vice CNO's office, Admiral Moran's been doing that, and they've been speaking with us, and they've been very good about these are the mitigating factors. But that why question is still outstanding for a lot of people. And I can understand the listener's concern and frustration because I think it's shared by a lot of other people who are pretty invested in this case on the legislative side, on the military side, and then, you know, on the big Pentagon side and the family side. I think that sentiment is pretty well reflected throughout a lot of different communities.
Who've gone to those memorial services, who gather now, and not everybody is able to attend the gathering because they were killed in combat, and you live with that. And it's almost like the Navy service community has been spared that. And the lessons are, you know, as you get in an airplane to fly there, it's, am I up to this? Am I going to be worthy of their trust and confidence? And, you know, I read the part about Lieutenant J.G. Kopic has the coordinates, the Latin lawn of where the accident tattooed on her wrist. You know, that's great. That's great. But guess what? It's not going to bring anybody back. And I will tell you, for her, it will be the most unkind fate for life because those, via their own negligence and their own culpability, who fail and cause the death of others, have to live with that burden forever. Nobody can lift that burden from their shoulders. And it is a cruel, terrible burden. But we're supposed to be better. We swear an oath. Other people depend on us. And it would be fitting when we fail if we paid the price. But when you're a leader, that's not the way it normally happens. And so it's been very interesting to watch. And I don't know, you know, I was extremely troubled when I saw that they had gone to NJP when 7 sailors, you know, had died. And I thought, how in God's name can that happen? But anyway, my guest this morning, Sam Legrand. Sam, I hope you don't mind in the future when this stuff becomes news if I bug you and drag you back on All Marine Radio to make it smart, if you don't mind.
Well, happy to do it.
All right. Well, first of all, A, thank you very much for coming on and doing this. B, enjoy your work. And for everybody, news.usni.org. And again, what I like about it is in a day and age when quote-unquote news – that term gets hijacked by people with editorial slants. What you'll find at news.usni.org is news. It's written like news. It is fact-based, and I want to compliment you for that, because that has become more and more rare in today's world of quote-unquote journalism. So thank you for what you do. Thank you for doing this, and hopefully in the future you can come back on and continue to explain this stuff to us.
Happy to do it. Thank you so much for having me on.
All right, bud. Go VMI.
Go VMI. Robert Jr. Mill.
All right, bud. Take it easy. That is Sam Legrand. He is the editor of the news department at usni.org. And my thanks to him for coming on. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Duffy White, former aide, military aide to the President of the United States, carried the football. You're going to hear my interview with him. Don't touch that dial. More of All Marine. As I said, Duffy's funny. All right. Whether we're going to talk about wrestling, you're going to hear some really cool stuff. One, the three coolest things that he did while he was the aide. Okay. I should ask for more, but he gave me three. And I'll tease them for you. One involves Nelson Mandela. One involves the space shuttle, and one involves a Medal of Honor. Okay, and so this is small world stuff. I met Duffy in 1989. He and I served together 1989, 1990, 1991. Mike Musselman does the march up with Duffy in 2003. They're in the same vehicle together, the same LAV together. Mike Musselman, you know him, Gunner, is the gunner in Duffy's LAV 25. So interesting stuff, small world stuff. So you're gonna meet Duffy White. Don't touch that dial. Interesting guy, funny guy. More of all, and again, I want to thank Sam Legrand for coming on. Just some final thoughts. The answers I've heard, in my opinion, haven't been good enough. I don't get it. Anybody who deploys to work 14 hours a day, that's a joke. The Navy whining about it, that's a joke. It's a tribute to their lack of deploying and the lack of hardness in their service. They've got used to these kind of business hours bullshit. All right. And let me tell you, there is no better trainer. We couldn't finish this training because we had to go to sea. Well, wait a minute. What's better training than going to sea and getting trained what's known as OJT? Is there a better trainer than that? I don't think so. Okay. So you have to adapt. Where are the leaders that are supposed to make that kind of shit happen? So really, we'd like to send you to Helmsman School, but you know what? You've already been to Helmsman Basic Course, right? We'd like you to send you to 7th Fleet Helmsman's Course, but guess what? We're not going to be able to do it. You're going to have to learn on the job, learning on our ship, on our systems, tutored by the best navigators and helmsmen that we have. That should work. Probably better, to be honest with you. So you can conquer those problems. You have to have leaders that are willing to do that. And that's what I don't understand about this shit. What I see is I see a leadership crisis in the service community of the United States Navy. I see subpar performers that have gotten people killed, that have run ships aground, that have run ships into other ships. And that's just what we know. And so suffice it to say that the guy who's the Secretary of Defense, he will unscrew them. There's no doubt in my mind about that. He will definitely unscrew them. But all these things, in my opinion, are excuses. They're excuses. And again, we're going to cross a shipping lane and we don't have anybody on the exterior of the ship because we're that confident in our technology. Obviously misplaced. Yay? Yay. Did it take this lesson to learn that? I would say for every one of these collisions, there's how many near misses that have been reported or maybe not reported. But if you're in that business, you know, you hear about it. But that watch isn't augmented. And we're going to do this. We have bridge standards that we're not real confident in. And there's no adult that's up there drinking a cup of coffee for an hour while we transit that. That's a leadership failure. Okay? That's a leadership failure. And I'll give you an example in the Marine Corps. Right? You think there's going to be enemy activity on a given night, right? And we're going to be at stand to 100% at dusk, at dawn, dusk, 100% at dawn and 100% at dusk alert. Then we can't stay that way all night. We've got to sleep, right? So we'll be at 50%, okay? We'll be at 50%, and then we'll go to 25. And then we'll come out to 50, and then we'll go to 100. Okay, so we'll kind of scale this thing, so that because we got to sleep, because we're gonna when the sun comes up, guess what? We got to go to work. So some people got to sleep. How do you ensure that you're at 100%, you're at 50%, you're at 25%? That you go to sleep and all the other leaders go to sleep because you've got to sleep too. Who supervises that? Who makes sure when you're at 100%, you're at 100%? Leaders do. Who makes sure that in the middle of the night at 2:30 in the morning? So you don't get overrun and everybody get their throat slit. Who makes sure that you're at 25% alert? Who goes from hole to hole to make sure that that 25% alert is awake? Some leader ought to be. Because if you don't do that, guess what you get? You get 100% asleep. And anybody who's in the infantry who doesn't do that, doesn't know that, is an amateur. If you're a professional, you're supposed to know this kind of shit. And you're supposed to, and if you're a leader, you mitigate it against it. That's how guys like Joe Dunford, right? That's how guys like Jim Mattis, that's how they made extremely successful careers. They do complicated stuff like that. Oh, that's really not very complicated. It's really pretty common sense if you're paying attention. So the negligence, so let me paint you a picture. We have less than qualified we have people that I'm not real confident in driving the ship at night. Okay. Got it. We have people in CIC that we're not real confident about. Got it. We're going to transit a shipping lane. Okay. So I've got that combination going, and I have a standing order that I want to keep the ship at between 20 and 22 knots. Okay. Does it occur to me that maybe I ought to be on the bridge at that time? I haven't even been out of port. It was first day out of port. Do you think what I'm you think, or maybe it's not me, but maybe the navigator, or maybe the XO, one of us adults ought to be there. Hmm. And let me ask you this about the radar. So one of the radars in the CIC doesn't get switched from long range to close in. Okay? So when that happens, right, and I'm on the bridge and I can see ships with binoculars. Wait a minute. Where did that guy come from? Why didn't CIC tell me about it? Get CIC on the phone. Ask them why they're not tracking that. So is it a stretch to say, well, we didn't see it? Well, can you check the radar? Is it functioning right? Stand by. We'll have one of our OSs check the radar. Oh, it was in the wrong mode. Sorry. Is that hard? If that's your job, if that's your MOS, if that's what you do? Or did all this like sneak up on us out of nowhere? That's bullshit. Nobody believes that. And then on top, the cherry on top for me, and this is when I went looking for him, when I went looking for Sam, is that the Navy NJP'd these people. NJP, that means you go see the ship's captain. And he says, yeah, you can, you know, you're going to get a letter of caution. But that's it? Seven people dead? And then the lieutenant says, I read it. It was like, I have no sympathy. I have those coordinates, tattooed on my wrist. So I will never forget them. Like, stop it. Stop it, okay? Stop it with the emotional bullshit. Guess what? This is what happens when you're not a leader. You get placed in charge of other people, and nobody supervises you. Left to your own devices, this is the kind of shit that happens. So, anyway. All right, Duffy White coming up next. Don't touch that dial. All Marine Radio continues. All these excuses, in my opinion, are nothing but that. They're nothing but excuses for failed leadership, right? Every one of us, as that email said, we've all deployed with people in billets that they shouldn't have been in. We've all deployed without everybody having their quals. We've all deployed with equipment that needed maintenance. Every one of us has done that. And what is the job of a leader? Your job as a leader is to make that stuff work. That's where you as a leader earn your money, because it can't always be perfect. And now what are we doing? Oh, we're going to have rules relative to sleeping. Good luck with that shit.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.